But next, let's move on. As Sung asked Montgomery, how did the religious right become so influential? So let's see what these guys have to say. Dig.
My name is C.S. Sung. Peter Montgomery, let's put this into historical perspective. The question comes up, how did the religious right come to be able to shape so much of the debate in, of around so-called traditional values? What is some of the key history we need to know about the Christian right?
Okay, let's try to do this in shorthand. Let's start with sort of the late 70s, and Paul Weyrich, Republican operative, looking out there and realizing that there were a lot of culturally conservative evangelical Christians in churches that were not very politically active, were not very engaged politically. There was actually some strains of Protestantism that thought that, you know, political action was sort of dirty and of the world. And he went and sat down with Jerry Falwell and said, you know, we can use your people to build a movement, and we can change this country if you are willing to sort of marry your you know, the persuasive power of your religious ministries to Republican politics and to right-wing politics. And that's where the Moral Majority came from. It did a lot of organizing and surprised a lot of people in 1980 by helping Ronald Reagan get elected and helping defeat a bunch of Democratic senators. And that was sort of the bursting on the scene, if you will, of the religious right as a political movement. Sort of next big thing might be Pat Robertson running for president.
In 1988?
1988, running against Bob Dole and the Republican Party and, you know, making some, you know, surprise in the Iowa caucus. And, you know, Robertson ended up not getting anywhere in terms of winning the nomination, but he ended up that campaign with almost 2 million names of supporters around the country. And he brought on this young political strategist, Ralph Reed, and said, here's this big database, build me a political organization. And they did that. And one of the things that Ralph Reed did, he is a very smart political strategist, and he realized that just railing about, you know, abortion and you know, calling your opponent Satanist and everything was not going to get them that far. So they sort of embraced the broader agenda of the Republican Party and sort of started talking about tax cuts as if they were somehow a Christian issue. And they also just really went to work at the retail level of politics. And all across the country, they encouraged people to get involved in running for local Republican precincts, local races. And 2 decades of that kind of really solid organizing has helped them, in many places, achieve what one of their stated goals was, which was to sort of take operational control of the Republican Party.
Okay, once again, the whole focus is, see, and this is because these guys aren't they don't have any kind of combative class consciousness. This is, like I said before, this whole horse race type thing. Look, them using these terms like moral majority, or this so-called hocus pocus moral majority that developed in the right, did they oppose the Southern strategy, which basically was a racist-based strategy, and it was really refined by Nixon. It started with Strom Thurmond, but Nixon refined it with Alderman, saying that we're going to divide the Democratic Party along primarily race, through the young, the poor, and the black. The young at the time were a lot of hippies and stuff. The poor, it's because they don't have proper work ethic. And the Negroes, because, well, they're Negroes, you know. And that's always good to, you know, try to get people to distance themselves from black people. In other words, and the way they did it was pushing this crime is out of control. delinquent behavior is out of control, drug abuse is out of control, and it all equals Negroes, and you don't want to be like them, and the Democrats are coddling the Negroes, and all so on and so forth. Alderman himself said, look, they refined it to make it look like all the social ills were the problem of the black people. So anyone associated with the black people, which, you know, the Democratic Party at that time had that kind of association, you know, of allegiance, becomes, you know, the party of immorality. Now, the only way to combat that type of stuff is to expose the way the Democrats play into it and the Republicans play into this whole moral majority. They're acting like these guys who play this moral majority slash Southern strategy ethic somehow have some kind of decent offering for the masses of working people, where all they have to offer them is division and a decline of everything under the sun that most people hold dearly: their health, their education system, their families, etc., etc. Now, once again, like, here's how the Democrats and those who support them get caught in a funnel. You have a situation where you had some little raggedy Catholics come out and tell Kerry he better get in line concerning abortion and stuff like that. Now, anyone with class consciousness would have said, look, let's have a meeting, priest. I'll be nice. Let's have it in private. Said, look, the next time one of you little and so-and-so says something out in the public like this, I'm going to do an investigation myself and all the little boys you guys are humping undercover and how you expose all y'all, because we know what's been going on. And in other words, the mere hypocrisy of the Catholic Church trying to stand up and make demands of anybody with all the shenanigans that have been popping up and popping in for the last 2 years about all these little boys, their little priests been humping and screwing over and, you know, causing all these psychological, you know, defects from and stuff. I mean, this is ridiculous. But see, since the whole construct is on personal behavior, quote unquote, moral value, not dying core over in Bosnia having sex slaves, you know, these guys, top execs and yeah, dying cores, buying these little girls, buying a brothel and holding them literally as sex slaves and stuff like that. Now, that's not a moral value issue, or how more people die in
some
a world.
Some of them are Democrats, Tracy.
That's the problem. And dying court gives to the Democrats just like the Republicans. See, that's why, once again, this is a privatization of your conduct. It's not the whole the morality issue is not the analysis and the lens on how the system itself works and how those within the corporations operate in a moral immoral way. So the fact that more people die in the workplace, more than twice as many, because of improper maintenance of the workplace facility, you know, labs and stuff like that blowing up and all of that, you stand twice as much of a chance of dying in the workplace because of criminal activity and or behavior and neglect in the workplace by the bosses and or corporation than you do on the streets. But the whole focus is on street personal behavior of, you know, individual working class people. That's what all those silly cop show, you know, bad boy, bad, all that junk. You know, you don't see them running into corporations, arresting the dying core people, you know, the Enron, the Halliburton, that criminal activity.
The serious criminal.
Right. The guy, you know, these guys blowing, factories up in India and stuff and exposing them and all of that type of stuff in Bhopal, you know. So it's all a con game to get you to try to look at one another as polar opposites and being fearful of one another. That's what this whole technology game is. Meanwhile, the fat cats in the corporations, just like the fat cats in the hocus pocus construct, you know, these guys in these churches and mosques and, you know, synagogues, they're living high and mighty like kings and stuff. You know,
you know what, though? Actually, we got a unique problem. And I forget this author that wrote a book called The Jesse Jackson Phenomenon. You know, he's from Chicago. I forgot the guy's name. But he pointed out, you know, we do have a problem in our community, in the black community, in terms of we give too much deference to these preachers. And I'm not talking about Republicans. Now, we just recently started seeing all these Negroes buying onto this Republican crap and telling people that it's a sin to vote for the Democrats. This actually came out during the election. But I'm talking about more famous religious leaders that we unfortunately can't seem to, you know, those of us who have the intelligence to do so lack the courage and the principle to criticize. And that is Farrakhan and Jesse Jackson. But they ran a con game on the so-called progressive movement for decades. Decades. Million Workers March. Jesse Jackson's two candidacy. Go ahead, Trace. But you see what I'm saying? So it's not just ultra-right wing.
Oh, no. But see, this whole particular thing is on the fact that you got liberals now on their knees saying, how should we try to address people who have this kind of conservative moral value type religious construct. Now, it's been clear. I mean, we've done things on Jackson and others, you know, Your Mind on Democratic Party, you know, featured him and others on that aspect. And it's been clear that much of the civil rights movement, you know, that was based in the whole, you know, kind of black church Christian tradition, many of them have been co-opted in other things into basically the bourgeois and also the bourgeois capitalist mode. Andrew Young basically is like a spokesman for many corporations, especially when they find themselves in trouble. So like a Nike Corporation, when Nike was finding itself in hot water, they got old Andrew Young with the so-called moral authority to go down to like Indonesia and other places to look at the sweatshops and to basically say what their script told them to say, that all's was good. You don't have to worry about it, black folks. Don't be concerned. Stop hassling Michael Jordan about that, because, you know, black people start saying, what's going on? You know, with these Nike sweatshops we're hearing about. You know, are these guys at it again? Are they trying to make new niggas throughout the world? You know, and once that type of fear and questioning starts happening in the black community, it takes a life of its own. And the next thing you know, many of these athletes and others, you know, whose image they want to protect, they want to protect their little image. So all of a sudden, they start hearing these questions coming out and stuff. So then they start, you know, stammering and getting a little hesitant and stuff about who and what they're endorsing. So when it reached Jordan, that's when Nike and others realized, okay, look, we got to go get us a coon with the moral authority, you know, religious background and all and on. Right now, Andrew Young is doing his little divisional work over in Africa. Helping corporations try to carve up, you know, the remaining souls in Africa and stuff, you know, in the western part primarily right now. I mean, it's just some sick stuff, you know. But but this particular show, let's deal next with As Sung As Montgomery.
Just for those who may not be aware, Andrew Young was one of the personal aides of Dr. Martin Luther King, who broke with Martin Luther King when Martin Luther King decided to oppose the Vietnam War. And Andrew Young very quickly joined the Democratic Party at that point.
Now, next, Sung asked Montgomery how progressives could embrace and address this hocus-pocus stuff. So let's see what these guys got to say.
Well, let me ask Peter. There's a great deal of discussion on the left about how progressives, how liberals can engage with religious and socially conservative Americans, what they can do to make inroads into that population. Now, we've already decided and discussed that that population is not a monolithic. There are many different facets and internal contradictions, perhaps, within that population. But some people are calling for the left to embrace, in a sense, religion. What's your take on that idea?
I think that the religious left should embrace religion in an authentic way, and that the secular left needs to, you know, be comfortable with that happening. You know, I think that one of the important things that the, in the big picture, for us to sort of not have the Christian right be successful in pulling to its side of the political contest a lot of people who aren't sort of hardcore supporters is that progressive people of faith feel comfortable talking about how their faith and values grounds, you know, their view of the world, their view of social justice issues. I think partly when the moral majority of Pat Robertson came up and sort of took the Bible and Christianity for themselves, a lot of progressive Christians, they sort of didn't want to be associated with any of that. And so they sort of haven't talked about that. Also, you know, with the tradition of separation of church and state, which is not in any way antithetical to Christianity and actually supports the religious freedom of Christians like everyone else, some people on the left or the Democratic Party have been uncomfortable with talking about faith in public life. And I think it can be done badly if people try to do it because they think they should and they think it sounds good. It's not going to sound good. It's not going to sound authentic. But I think when we have public officials, left progressive public officials for whom faith is part of their life, they ought to talk about that. They ought to share that with people. And it's a way of telling America that you know, we don't believe you have to give up your faith in order to support progressive policies. And in fact, you know, a huge amount of history of Christian social teaching would be firmly in the camp of progressive policies on worker rights, on economic justice, on foreign policy. So I think, you know, look, I think some people out there can be looked to as role models on this. I think the speech that Barack Obama gave at the Democratic Convention, he spoke of his faith in a way that I don't think was offensive to anyone. It was not in any kind of a threatening way, but was in a way of sharing that that's part of who he is and how he has built his view and his work toward justice.
Hold on, y'all. Listen here. Let me just say this here. Obama, whatever the hell his name is, said that shit for the same opportunist, scummy reasons that Boy George says it. It's to politically exploit the oppressed masses. Let's get real. Number one, when you talk about religious left, secular left, this is an abomination, if not an oxymoron. In fact, let's talk about where did the word left first come to be? Because that would help, maybe. Okay. There was a little event that occurred in France around the late 1700s called the French Revolution. As that revolution evolved, and the revolutionaries started to really see that they were going to have to take care of business, what did they do? Well, one, they cut the king's head off. Nonviolent, huh? Cut his head off. Okay. Two, they took all the power away from who? The church. They said, hell with this here foolishness about the God picked this man to be the king and he coming in here and then the next thing I know, man, forget this foolishness. Your ass is through. Anybody want to go to church? Go to church. But y'all ain't got no separation of church and state. This country is moving backward, y'all. Backward. Now, in that context, where does the word left come from? Well, when they first formed that French parliament, all the revolutionaries hanged out at one side of the building. They call that the left side. So they began to traditionally talk about the left as being the revolutionaries, as being the people that were for change. Ain't no goddamn Osama, whatever the hell his name is, for no damn change. This is the left of people like this. Now, I guess you could take out a microscope and look on the table and say one molecule is to the left of another molecule. And I guess that might even be factually correct. But to call these public officials leftists, these people are demoralized to the marrow of their bones. Religious left? Please.
And you know, when, you know, another thing that, Barack Obama also said was that, next on the agenda should be the attacking of Iran. So after all of his hocus pocus talk, kill, 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 was the next thing out of his lips babbling.
Jesus told me.
He also goes into this how, the left and progressives, quote unquote, should embrace religion in an authentic way. This is just being compromised, you know, as if there's some kind of authentic aspect to this whole hocus pocus stuff. That, you know, once again, these are just broken down people. And then he goes into how people now in the progressive movement don't like talking about religion because, you know, they feel it's been co-opted and all that. Look, every time you turn around, there's some little liberal or progressive talking about some hope. It's just in their own little version, you know, space age stuff. You know, they got shows on KPFA. You know, where they do all this, the moon was here the other day and all of that type of stuff. And the unicorn, is just right with Sagittarius. And, you know, the jackal of this and that. No, I mean, this babbling on and on and turning over tarot cards in the middle of the show. It's unbelievable.
But it's true.
So to say that, you know, you got these people running around thinking they're really witches and stuff, are wicca, wicca, and upset, you know, like a personal relative of them got burned in Salem, you know, and they can still feel the flames and all this posturing and upset about how people are treating Halloween because their ancestor is a true, you know, I mean, this on and on. These liberals and progressives just go with this type of stuff, you know. So it's not with just in the construct of the Abrahamic tradition, the Christians, Islams, and Hebrons that do their little babbling. These so-called progressives just take it to their little state. But to show how there is another version of a liberal twist, and how they twist themselves into a circle. Bernie Ward, you know, he's like a talk show host on an AM, 810 AM KGO. Now, he has his regular liberal show he does at night. But he also has his hocus pocus show, because he's all into, you know, the hocus pocus Christianity. It's called God Talk.
Oh,
and, he gets into it with his little callers and stuff. But this show helps show how Ward and callers twist themselves around into hocus pocus circles as Ward deals with some of the issues at hand, and then Anne, a caller, calls in and gets into the issue of can God regret. So let's check this stuff out. Check it out.
Those of us who believe in God should be doing whatever he wants, because he's doing the work of God. Why would we disagree with him? How could you disagree with him? And I go back to my question. If God put George Bush in office precisely because of September 11th, why didn't God stop September 11th? I mean, is there anybody out there that doesn't think that's a little weird? You consciously choose to put George Bush in office to handle a tragedy that you consciously choose to let happen so that you can put George Bush in office so he can handle it? Is there anybody else who thinks that's just a tad bit crazy? Ann in Greenfield, welcome to KGL with Bernie Ward.
Ways back there, you asked if God can regret something.
Yeah.
I find a passage in my Bible, and it says, and the Lord was grieved. So, you know, grieved is regret.
Well, the problem is you have to decide what kind of a God you believe in. If God knows everything
merely ask if God can regret.
Right. But if God knows everything before God does it, how can God regret?
You merely ask the question.
Well, I never merely ask a question.
Well,
so my
ask
question to you
question.
Is okay, so now I ask you this. If you believe that God can regret,
I want to get over the first regret question.
Well, but see, the problem with that is it depends on how you view God. If you believe in an omniscient God, then God can't regret.
I believe my Bible.
What does that mean? Which Bible? What do you read?
NIV.
Okay, and what do you do with people who read Bibles that translate things differently, and they believe their Bible? Which Bible is right? You believe your Bible. What do you do with people who read the King James Bible? They say they believe their Bible. Which Bible is right?
I'm talking about your comment about regret.
Well, I know we've gotten beyond that, and I'm saying that it depends. But it depends on how you view God. Am I speaking Russian? 7:59 on KGO. God Talk. I'm Bernie Ward. Здравствуйте, как вы поживаете? KGO, San Francisco, Oakland.
Now, see, that just shows, man. you try to have a little hocus-pocus show, which you should be ashamed of, but if that's your thing, and this is what you get, you know?
That stuff limits your ability to reason.
Conversations twisting you around about regret and this and that. Well, it says that God can. It depends on what type of God you believe in. I mean, my Bible. What Bible? It's endless.
No, but do you understand? She was unable to reason, though.
Of course.
I was listening. And okay, you took a position. You said your Bible said that God could feel grief and therefore regret. Okay, that's your interpretation of that. Now let's go point B. No, I'm still on point A. Oh, Lord. That's because that shit eats your mind up. It really do. When you occupy your mind with illogic, ignorance, dogma, this is what happens to you. Leave that Bible alone, y'all. I read it already. I left it alone when I was 11.
And that's the whole point. Now to see liberals and progressives try to get into that quicksand of feces, you know, and wallow around, you know.
You know what, Tracy? I think some of them, it might be good for some of them to do that. Some of them need to go back because it'll finish them off. And they'll be through, off the terrain. Stop babbling on the air. Stop lying. Stop giving out, spreading illusions. Stop all they. Look here. It might be a good
thing. Dangerous part is they may take, just like the Christian right, you know, another.
That's with them, huh?
Right. That's the scary part. Then it is over. It's over then. At that point, it's over.
But you know what? You know what I really think? While it's true that America is the most politically backward industrial country in the world, the American working class can't go back all the way. No, we can't. It's the middle class that's embraced all these fads and this hocus-pocus stuff. Yes, they are religious workers, no doubt. But you want to know something? Every day, We got to get up, get ourselves prepared, get our children off to school, get to that job, get to grinding, come home, fill out some tax documents, keep our kids out of trouble, keep our families together. Oh no, baby. We ain't got no time for too much hocus pocus.
Well, people have sedated themselves like drugs with way too much as it is. I mean, a lot of this is a false type of lubrication or a fixed high in a form of denial. You know, much of the American construct and foundation is based off of myths. And clear-cut examination and analysis often brings people down to a reality. And when people have been loaded up like junkies, they don't like going on cold turkey. And much of the American population has been in this kind of false John Wayne high, their version of the slave trade, their version of the American experience and expansion into the West and
false.
The American Indian
myths.
Right. The whole thing of how Sam really got himself into the Vietnam War, Panama War, so on and so forth.
Right.
That's why a large portion of this population really does not mind the fact, too large, of that they are really getting little bits and pieces of what's going on in Iraq. That it's not a real good ground coverage. That the reporters are not embedded. There's a part of the American population that doesn't want the truth. It doesn't want to face reality. It's stayed in a kind of juvenile state where it still believes in the American dream like a little kid wants to believe in the tooth fairy. And with this type of form of a mythological illusion and Peter Pan type of mentality, this has in many ways corrupted the souls of an incredible large portion of the American population that could look you in the eye and justify, with all of the contradictions that have happened, America's latest exploits in Iraq and Iran. They'll turn around and look you in the eye and scream about how Arafat was the great terrorist and not put any of their lens on Sharon and know about Sharon's own personal career and stuff. There's a form of denial. As I've outlined before, you know, many people have seen these Civil War movies and stuff, and they always got these noble Southerners, you know, fighting for states' rights and, you know, all of this God-fearing rhetoric, like I mentioned before, out of the Southern Baptist convention. And, you know, people have heard me talk about the whole thing concerning, you know, these little Confederates trying to burn up all of New York and making coal bombs and all of that type of stuff. You don't see movies and, you know, discussions about that. Yeah. What I said about the whole biological attacks by the South, the chemical attacks using Greek fire against the American population, often this rings to people like there's something from outer space. Even though there were trials against, you know, like R.C. Kennedy, he was convicted, he was executed, you know, the rest of the Confederates got away. You know, first Kennedy ran off to Canada, then he tried to make it back to his own little hick country in the South and stuff, got his ass caught. You know, the Northerners, and especially the New Yorkers, they wanted that ass. They wanted to kill him right there. He had his little trial, got convicted, knew he did it, you know, wrote stuff about what he did and all of that type of stuff. got his ass lynched.
You know what, man? Just on this point that you're making, because it just came to me so powerful about their lies. They made a movie just recently, and there has been a trend in American movies for some reason to be a little bit more honest in what's going on the political field. So they made this movie, Martin Solstra, I think, was the producer, The Gangs of New York, in which they went specifically, Tracy, over what you were just talking about, over, they touched on, like, how these Irish gangs evolved, and then they went into the draft riots in 1964, 63 or 4, in New York City, during the Civil War. And it just comes to mind really clearly. They took out, they made you act somewhat sympathetic towards the rioters, and took out the racial component of those riots. They didn't show the black people being lynched everywhere. They showed these rioters attacking rich folks, as if that's what it was really about. That impulse may have been there, but as soon as the police shot a few of them, they ran and attacked the Negroes.
And he was screaming,
with impunity, by the way.
No war for niggas. That was one of their slogans. And the same way you'll see these Southern hick movies, and you don't see...
That's a modern movie. That movie was just 2-3 years ago.
No, and like I'm saying, you see all these Confederate movies, you don't see them talking about... I mean, that would be a good movie on the whole thing of the plot by Jefferson Davis and all of them to burn up New York City, and how they targeted the various landmark hotels and used Greek fire and stuff like that. But see, that would then bring light, a real light, to an image about what happened in the South and the whole Confederacy and what that flag stands for and all of that type of stuff that they don't want to address.
Exactly. Make people think a little deeper.
Right. Now, next, C.S. Asks Montgomery, can the left learn from the religious right? So check this.
In terms of lessons, Peter Montgomery, does the left, do progressives, can they learn anything from the brief history of the religious right's ascendancy and how they gained power and how they gained access to the organs of power? Is there something the left might learn from the way the religious right built itself that could help them?
Well, I think we've seen an amazing resurgence of energy on the progressive side of the political arena in the last couple of years. And I think the willingness to invest in building grassroots organizations, to invest in, you know, media, all of that is in some ways you could say, you know, following in the steps
of
what the
right
has done. I think the number of people who've been involved in the last couple of years who've been inspired by their involvement through,
now,
you know, one of the Yvonne.org or some other organization that's been organizing progressives to get involved, maybe you start getting involved at the local level in electoral politics, running for local seats. I think that's all part of how you go about building power. And I don't think the progressives need to sort of get panicked by this values thing into thinking that we don't have values and we've got to go get ourselves some. I mean, we have values that actually resonate more with the majority of Americans than the religious rights values. If you poll people,
We need a poll for this?
The fact is, we haven't done as good a job talking about it. As the work that we need to do, I think a lot of it is figuring out how to talk about values that do reach to those people in the middle who, may have voted for George Bush, even though they're not thrilled with his stances, and they're certainly, not part of the radical right. And I think, you mentioned a Catholic vote. I think it's really unfortunate that so many of the bishops have, put gay marriage and abortion to the exclusion of almost all this other Catholic social justice teaching when it came to the election. But I think that if you had progressives who, when they talk about choice, can talk about choice in the value of a woman, and not just the value, the moral value of women having choice, and not just in the term of a legal right of a woman having choice, that can acknowledge. I think one of the things that progressives haven't done well is to acknowledge the legitimacy of the moral concerns and the moral questions. You know, for those liberal Catholics who aren't, you know, necessarily hard right or with the bishops, but are kind of in the middle that Nikhil mentioned, you know, to acknowledge to them, yes, this can be a difficult moral question. You know, we're struggling with, you know, society's right to ensure women's autonomy and women as moral decision makers. But yeah, there is a moral question when you're talking about late-term abortion, and that makes it difficult. You know, I think we're afraid that if we acknowledge that people are wrestling with moral questions, and we understand that we're somehow giving in on our principles. And I don't think so. I think people would view that as a very respectable reaching out.
I'm sorry, brother. I'm sorry. I try to. You know, they're telling me we got to respect. No, you don't never respect no foolishness like that. Now, I'm sorry. I really feel sorry for Mr. C.S. Song and his guests here. This is absolutely ridiculous. But it requires a little historical lesson. Historically, in the history of this planet, it has always been, ever since the bourgeoisie, the capitalists, has existed as an independent class that taken power after the French Revolution in that period. It has always been the left that went out and organized the grassroots and masses of people. And that is why the capitalists had to depend on what? The state, the media, the bourgeois corporate media today, but the state especially, the church, and the fascist vigilantes to fight the masses. You see? Because the masses have always historically organized themselves and, of course, developed and chosen leadership to take their fight forward. But it has always been, if you looked at the mass trade unions and put that next to the, let's say, the Entrepreneurs League, it'd be drafted. There's always going to be less employers than workers. The mass movement of the working people and the oppressed dwarfs any kind of right-wing movement. We're talking about media stuff here, you know, and these preachers, they got a well-organized network, but they're not the millions. We are. We are the millions. This program is for the millions. And don't y'all ever listen to no foolishness like this and think for 1 minute that we got anything to learn. Here's what we got to learn. We want to know where their address is.
And also, the what they're doing is making you more susceptible to get caught up in this whole Democratic Party claptrap and demoralize it. Because if you get caught up in that type of stuff and put your energy, you will become demoralized. You will become lost. Or the majority will. Some will harden up and say, look, there's got to be a better way than this. But it's not necessary at this day and age for people to go through this experience who are developing themselves politically. There has to be a point where we learn from our lessons of the past and not just keep recycling this type of stuff and being susceptible to the same type of dogma and stuff. As I said before, faith is not objectivity. It's not based in objectivity. It must in part use symbolisms. So you can get caught up in symbolisms,
right,
gestures, symbols, and symbolic acts of goodwill. You know, in other words, like what the churches and mosques would do. Recently, some mosque or whatever in San Jose did this. They were passing out food for the homeless and all of that. and all that's, you know, okay, whatever, and all that. But what do organizations and federations and committees that are serious and stuff do? What did the Panthers do? While they passed out free food, they also organized people to examine and to fight the system that put them in the position of needing free food in the first place. In a, you know, and that was because they lived in a capitalist system that deprived them of being able to feed themselves, that puts a monetary value on things that's just completely outrageous and stuff. Now, this, at the same time, these various institutions that are passing out free food and all of that, that's all for imaging part and stuff, because they're not based in really fighting the structure themselves, so these are symbolic acts and stuff. And by the way, if you're examine and to fight the system that put them in the position of needing free food in the first place. In a, you know, and that was because they lived in a capitalist system that deprived them of being able to feed themselves, that puts a monetary value on things that's just completely outrageous and stuff. Now, this, at the same time, these various institutions that are passing out free food and all of that, that's all for imaging part and stuff, because they're not based in really fighting the structure themselves, so these are symbolic acts and stuff. And by the way, if you're tax-free, it's easier for you to be, you know, to get away. The people who are often hungry, not just homeless people, who have jobs and stuff, their lives aren't tax-free. They're getting taxed all the time. But these churches and mosques and synagogues and all of that type of stuff. But if you just go by the image of, you know, old people and young people all handsomely, quote-unquote, dressed, giving you free food and all of this good nature type of act, then it gives the impression that these people of faith have this kind of high moral value.
They're blessed.
Yeah, without understanding that they just fit in within a construct that sets you all up for this type of thing to go on.
Yeah, boy, I don't know. Tracy, this is probably the low point for CSR and them. You know, I ain't never heard nothing so pitiful and slimy. Because, as I said before, remember, and always remember this, it's not just true historically, it's true today, mass movements. And what I mean is this. When the wars were going on, when the war was going on with Iraq, right, when it first got started, the liberal and anti-war movement went around, and we had, what, 250,000 people in San Francisco, 200,000 people in New York, 500,000 people in London. You know, it was clear. Now, the right wing did organize anti-war rallies. And I want y'all to know that Clear Channel, that's right, was the organizer of these pro-war rallies. But the largest one they had anywhere in the country was outside of Atlanta in Georgia. And I believe it was like 20,000 people. Now, I may be wrong about that. It may have been slightly more, maybe double. But the point is, it didn't even come close to the hundreds of thousands mobilized all over this country against Boy George and his assault on Iraq. So if they so organized, why couldn't they out-organize the left? I tell you why, because they're not that organized. These boys are demoralized to the marrow of their bones. They're finished, through, done, of no use to the working class and oppressed. It's not true. They're not that well organized. They're blowing smoke up your ass. What they got is these preachers who people go to and bow their head and they tell them how to vote and then they... Yeah, but that's a very casual relationship, brothers and sisters. That's not you out. They're not out on the street. Onward, Christian soldier. Or they say, look, take this gun and go fight the devil. No, not me. I ain't get my ass shot off behind your crazy ass. Oh, but I thought you knew. Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. That's voting is one. See, voting is a very low level of commitment, actually. Let's understand. That's not overrated here. You know, ain't a revolution ever been made on this earth where the ballot box was the key issue. Believe me. All right? So let's just understand that. So here we go. Now they given, they done went from defeat to self-pity, talking about the power of these religious right organizations. Their power is our weakness.
And what's also fascinating is that they don't even see that, you know, if and when the Democrats do take up some of these tactics, which they have, it's just a way of attacking the so-called base of their party and people who are within it in the same fashion that the right does. Take, for example, when crime Bill Clinton first ran for office, what did he do? He did this moral accountability ploy towards Sister Soldier, and he attacked her at some little, you know, like NAACP convention. That was basically to send out a message to the NASCAR dad types, the soccer moms, the little religious types, that look, I's down with your guys' program too. I too can stomp on the Negroes and attack them of not being morally accountable and all of that type of stuff. So crime Bill Clinton used that whole technique himself. So it's not like they don't from time to time do this. And that's because at the same time, they are our class opponents. They're just trying to get elected. It's just a horse race to them. So to not see them for what they really are and what they're doing, and to not address the masses of working people in a way that will crystallize their vision, not fog up their vision, is basically to be a class traitor.
You can't even call these sorry son bitches traitors, because they ain't never been on our side in the first place.
You're right. They just, but the posing and stuff, it's that, you know, they address these issues and concerns that people in the working class often have. They'll address issues of clean drinking water and education and all of that type of stuff. So they'll have many working class people's attention and concern, and they'll portray themselves as having their interests. But right in the middle of that, they're pulling Kerry out of the hat and saying, this is the way to go forward. And then they stick his head back in, and then they pull Pat Robinson or image of Pat Robinson and say, and this is the type of constituency we need to try to penetrate to get Kerry, who's also in that hat, elected. Not realizing that they're all in that hat for a reason. They all wear that hat.
For the same reason that Kerry conceded. For the same reason that Kerry said he could kill more terrorists than George Bush. For the same reason that Kerry said he finished George, old boy George's war. They are one and the same. They are Republicans. They are a single party of the rich against the interests of you and I.
Hold on a sec.
Basically, what we were trained to do and what our job is to build up the American empire, to create situations where as many resources as possible flow into this country, to our corporations and our government. And in fact, we've been very successful. We've built the largest empire in the history of the world, It's been done over the last 50 years since World War II with very little military might, actually. It's only in rare instances like Iraq where the military comes in as a last resort. This empire, unlike any other in the history of the world, has been built primarily through economic manipulation, through cheating, through fraud, through seducing people into our way of life, through the economic hitmen. Well, I was initially recruited while I was in business school back in the late 60s by the National Security Agency, the nation's largest and least understood spy organization. But ultimately, I worked for private corporations. The first real economic hitman was back in the early 1950s, Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Teddy, who overthrew the government of Iran, a democratically elected government, Mossadegh's government, who was the Times Magazine Person of the Year. And he was so successful at doing this without any bloodshed, well, there was a little bloodshed, but no military intervention, just spending millions of dollars, and replaced Mossadegh with the Shah of Iran. That at that point, we understood that this idea of economic hitmen was an extremely good one. We didn't have to worry about the threat of war with Russia when we did it this way. The problem with that was that Roosevelt was a CIA agent. He was a government employee. Had he been caught, we would have been in a lot of trouble. It would have been very embarrassing. So at that point, the decision was made to use organizations like the CIA and the NSA to recruit potential economic hitmen like me, and then to send us to work for private consulting companies, engineering firms, construction companies, so that if we were caught, there would be no connection with the government. Well, the company I worked for was a company named Charles T. May in Boston, Massachusetts. We were about 2,000 employees, and I became its chief economist. I ended up having 50 people working for me. But my real job was deal-making. It was giving loans to other countries, huge loans, much bigger than they could possibly repay. And one of the conditions of the loan, let's say a $1 billion loan to a country like Indonesia or Ecuador, and this country would then have to give 90% of that loan back to a U.S. company or U.S. companies to build the infrastructure, a Halliburton or a Bechtel. These were big ones. And those companies would then go in and build an electrical system or ports or highways. And these would basically serve just a few of the very wealthiest families in those countries. The poor people in those countries would be stuck ultimately with this amazing debt they couldn't possibly repay. A country today like Ecuador owes over 50% of its national budget just to pay down its debt. And it really can't do it. So we literally have them over a barrel. So when we want more oil, we go to Ecuador and say, look, you're not able to repay your debts, therefore give our oil companies your Amazon rainforests, which are filled with oil. And today we're going in and destroying Amazonian rainforests, forcing Ecuador to give them to us because they've accumulated all this debt. So we make this big loan. Most of it comes back to the United States. The country's left with the debt, plus lots of interest, and they basically become our servants, our slaves. It's an empire. There's no two ways about it. It's a huge empire. It's been extremely successful. Well, I accepted a $500,000 bribe in the 90s, not to write the book, from a major construction engineering company. Legally speaking, it wasn't a Stoner Webster. Legally speaking, it wasn't a bribe. It was that I was being paid as a consultant. This is all very legal, but I essentially did nothing. It was very understood, as I explained in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, that it was understood when I accepted this money as a consultant to them, I wouldn't have to do much work, but I mustn't write any books about the subject, which they were aware that I was in the process of writing this book, which at the time I called Conscience of an Economic Hitman. You know, it's an extraordinary story from the standpoint of, it's almost James Bondish, truly. And when the National Security Agency recruited me, they put me through a day of lie detector tests. They found out all my weaknesses and immediately seduced me. They used the strongest drugs in our culture, sex, power, and money to win me over. I come from a very old New England family, Calvinist, steeped in amazingly strong moral values. I think I'm a pretty good person and overall, and I think my story really shows how this system and these powerful drugs of sex, money, and power can seduce people, because I certainly was seduced. And if I hadn't lived this life as an economic hitman, I think I'd have a hard time believing that anybody does these things. And that's why I wrote the book, because our country really needs to understand, if people in this nation understood what our foreign policy is really about, what foreign aid is about, how our corporations work, where our tax money goes. Remember well in the early 70s how OPEC exercised this power it had and cut back on oil supplies. We had cars lined up at gas stations. The country was afraid that it was facing another 1929 type of crash, depression, and this was unacceptable. So the Treasury Department hired me and a few other economic hitmen. We went to Saudi Arabia in the early 70s, and we knew Saudi Arabia was the key to dropping our dependency to controlling the situation. And we worked out this deal whereby the Royal House of Saud agreed to send most of their petrodollars back to the United States and invest them in U.S. government securities. The Treasury Department would use the interest from these securities to hire U.S. companies to build Saudi Arabia, new cities, new infrastructure, which we've done. And the House of Saud would agree to maintain the price of oil within acceptable limits to us, which they've done all these years. And we would agree to keep the House of Saud in power as long as they did this, which we've done, which is one of the reasons we went to war with Iraq in the first place. And in Iraq, we tried to implement the same policy that had been so successful in Saudi Arabia, but Saddam Hussein didn't buy. When the economic hitmen fail in this scenario, the next step is what we call the jackals. Jackals are CIA-sanctioned people that come in and try to foment a coup or revolution. If that doesn't work, they perform assassinations, or try to. In the case of Iraq, they weren't able to get through to Saddam Hussein. His bodyguards were too good. He had doubles. They couldn't get through to him. So the third line of defense, if the economic hitmen and the jackals fail, the next line of defense is our young men and women who are sent in to die and kill, which is what we've obviously done. Omar Torrijos, the president of Panama. Omar Torrijos had signed the canal treaty with Carter, it passed our Congress by only one vote. It was a highly contended issue. And Torrijos then also went ahead and negotiated with the Japanese to build a sea-level canal. The Japanese wanted to finance and construct a sea-level canal in Panama. Torrijos talked to them about this, which very much upset Bechtel Corporation, whose president was George Shultz, and senior counsel was Caspar Weinberger. When Carter was thrown out, and that's an interesting story how that actually happened, when he lost the election and Reagan came in, and Shultz came in as Secretary of State from Bechtel, and Weinberger came from Bechtel to be Secretary of Defense, they were extremely angry at Torrijos. Tried to get him to renegotiate the canal treaty and not to talk to the Japanese. He adamantly refused. He was a very principled man. He had his problems, but he was a very principled man. He was an amazing man, Torrijos. And so he died in a fiery airplane crash, which was connected to a tape recorder with explosives in it, I was there. I'd been working with him. I knew that we economic hitmen had failed. I knew the jackals were closing in on him. And the next thing, his plane exploded with a tape recorder with a bomb in it. There's no question in my mind that it was CIA sanctioned, and many Latin American investigators have come to the same conclusion. Of course, we never heard much about that in our country. I felt guilty throughout the whole time, but I was seduced. The power of these drugs, sex, power, and money was extremely strong for me. And, of course, I was doing things I was being patted on the back for. I was chief economist. I was doing things that Robert McNamara liked and so on. The World Bank provides most of the money that's used by economic hitmen, it in the IMF. But when 9/11 struck, I had a change of heart. I knew the story had to be told.
Clear that anyone who supports the capitalist system, whether they call themselves liberals or progressives, conservatives, or a hocus-pocus type that bends their knees to some invisible man in the sky in the name of the Christians, Islams, or Hebrons, you are, in essence, an economic hitman. Enslave for the ruling class. Well, on Slave Revolt, I guess I'm just a sinner man for the liberation of our people throughout the world. Until the next time, Slave Revolt.
It was boiling around to the sea. It was boiling.